getting close to this morning's talk. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the first talk. And to begin with, I like giving these morning talks on meditation, because if I give a talk on theories, people end up spending the rest of the day thinking. But nevertheless, somebody did ask me, so can you talk a little bit about dependent origination? But first of all, the warning. And the warning is that story, another story of the professor. There was a professor of philosophy who liked his food and heard that there was a new 5-star Michelin rated chef visiting town. And so he tried to get a booking at his restaurant. But it was full, it was packed. He had to wait for a couple of months using some of his contacts to get a seat in this prestigious restaurant with a 5-star chef. And finally, when his booking, his reservation came up, he dressed in a very sharp suit, a nice tie, because to get into these restaurants, it's not like getting into Jhana Grove. These need a dress code. So when he turned up, the maitre d', who stands outside, said, "Sir, have you got a reservation?" He said, "Yes, I have. What is your name? Show me your ID." So he showed him his ID, and the maitre d' checked him off. "Yes, sir, you have a reservation today. Welcome." And the maitre d' took him to his seat at this very amazing restaurant. Beautiful mahogany table, covered with this beautiful lace mats for the food. The china was exquisite, and not like we have here. I mean, you wouldn't sort of even touch it. It'd probably worth too much. And then the butler came and showed him the menu. And even the menu was printed on thick card with gold embroidery on the edge. And the letters of the menu, it was not what you find in McDonald's. This was really nice calligraphy. And when the waiter left the professor with the menu, then the professor continued. He looked at the menu first of all, and then he ate the menu, paid his bill and left. Because the problem with the professor, he didn't know the difference between the menu and the food. So sometimes people know all the theories. They can out argue me and everybody else on the meaning of the Dhamma. But have they tasted the food yet? No. So it's okay to have a menu, but make sure you eat the food. Otherwise you go hungry. So anyway, so with that little warning in place, I did promise dependent origination. What's it all about? Now, basically, there's a question which people often ask monks in today's world. Said, "Well, you guys and girls, you nuns, you believe in reincarnation or rebirth, but you don't believe there's a solid self or a soul. How can you be reborn without something to be reborn?" And that's the sort of question we often get. And that's in particular what dependent origination was supposed to answer. But to go back where it all came from. Because, like many people, they were wondering, why do we have to suffer in this world? Why? And I even remember just studying, I think it was St. Augustine, who's a very famous Christian theologian. He said his God cannot be all compassionate and all powerful at the same time. It's a very simple argument, and this is one of the reasons why great philosophers, they can put an argument so simple, but just so hard to disprove. He said, if the God was all powerful, then why does he do something? You know, when sort of there's suffering in the world? Because he can't be compassionate. Or if he's compassionate, he can't do anything about it. He's not got the full power. But you can't have a being which is all compassionate and all powerful at the same time. Otherwise, there would be such unacceptable, meaningless suffering in this world. And I'm sure all of you have come across that. So it all started out with the Buddha search on the experience of suffering. Basically, that life is unpredictable. It doesn't matter how wealthy, how much you look after your body, how healthy your food is, still people get sick and they die. And I remember I was really into health foods and living a healthy life when I was very young. I remember just watching this TV show called Yoga for Health. And it had these, you know, from the United States, and there was these two presenters. This guy really fit like an Olympic athlete, but there's also the girl presenter. I was a young man, and I watched it mainly for her. She was really hot. I admit these things. But I also practiced some, and I was really surprised that when I became a monk, I said, oh, that program, yeah, still going, but he died on set. Had a heart attack. I mean, okay, you may think it's illogical, but that kind of shook me. So even if you look after your health, still, you can die. There's no guarantee. There's many other things which happen. And so, similar with the Buddha, seeing old age, sickness and death, realizing that someday will come to him, he can't escape it. And the question is, why? What is the meaning of this life? I remember it was put in some very beautiful words by, I think, Suzuki Roshi, over in the United States. I'm not sure where he got it from, but I thought this was really cool. Life. It's like going on a boat journey into the ocean, knowing that you're going to sink at sea and never come back. You set off in a boat, going out into the ocean, knowing it's never going to come back to land anymore. Sinking at sea, your life. There's no going back. You set out on the journey of this life, and it ends in death. Ah! Well then, what's the point? So anyway, so like many people, the Buddha was, ooh, what we do? And then started thinking, why? Why do people die? And of course, the answer, as I mentioned yesterday, sometimes the most obvious answers are the ones we miss. And the answer was, because we're born. And, Bianca's not here, but there was a good old friend, disciple, Judy Rushforth. She died last year, and died in her sleep, so I had to have a bit of an autopsy. And when we did the funeral for her, you know, they hadn't told me what the results of the autopsy were, and I said, I don't mind. And I took the opportunity, because I knew her very well, she wouldn't have minded me telling a joke at her funeral. And I said, many people have asked me what her cause of death was, and I told the story of the Buddhist coroner. Now, the Buddhist coroner has to sign the death certificates, the reason why. And this Buddhist coroner got the sack. He got fired from his position, because every time he had to write down cause of death, he'd always write birth. Well, that's so true. Why did he die? Because he was born. And that's as far as I know about Judy, because I never actually bothered to find out, because I already knew. She died because she was born. Now that's not a joke, that's very powerful. Because once you're born, it's a bit of out of control. It's like that boat, never knowing when it's going to sink at sea, but it can't come back anymore. So understanding that, the problem comes, dependent origination, the cause of old age, suffering and death is birth. You can ameliorate it, you can lessen it, you can give it some sort of meaning in life, some sort of understanding, but it's going to happen to you. and to me as well. So, we come back, why are we born? And of course, this understands, and to me, I just can't get my head around why people don't see the obvious truth of, you know, we've been born many times. And we come back again. And there's so many stories, I've seen so much in my life, and it's, I think, what do they say in the X-Files? The truth is out there. And actually, did you see there is a UFO outside? Parked in our car park? I pointed it out to David this morning. There's a car with a number plate, UFO. I got my suspicions who the alien is on my retreat. But they haven't been confessed yet. But anyway, so the truth is out there about, you know, that many people have been born many times before. And so, where do we come from when we're born? What is the cause of birth? And of course, the cause of that birth is a combination of things. You're born because you want to be born. You haven't had enough yet. You want to come back again and do some more. And that's one of the main causes of rebirth. You want to have another go. Next time, you'll do it better, so you think. You've learned all these techniques. You know, if you want a nice partner, just how to get the right one. If you want to sort of get rich, how to have a wonderful time, and not make all the same mistakes you made this life. Have another try. Next time, you can do it better. That's what you said last time. But there you go again. So that's what sometimes we think. So it's because of wanting, craving, which they say is one of those factors in dependent origination. The word is dhanha. I'm going to go back to sort of easy meditation afterwards. But the craving is just a bit too intense a word. Dhanha literally means thirst. Yeah, you can sort of put aside thirst for a while and keep going on. But it's more just the wanting, the thirst for experience, the wanting of new adventures, wanting to try again, wanting to have another go, always wanting something more, never being satisfied with what you have, never actually realizing the beauty of and the satisfaction of what you have, always wanting something more. The whole of life is like that, always wanting something more. So people hardly ever stop. And even when they retire, they don't have to go to work anymore. And what happens? They do more work. I don't know how many people tell me this. Oh, we're tired now. I'm more busy than when I worked. Well, why don't you go back to work and make some money for it? But anyway, we're always doing something, wanting something. So it's the wanting is what we call creates the fuel. The fuel is the upadana, the fuel of existence. When sometimes people call upadana attachment, that doesn't cut it for me. Because upadana literally means, right, ardhana, like in the precepts, adin ardhana. Ardhana means taking. Taking up, it literally means taking up. Sucking up the fuel, sucking it up. The fuel from wanting creates existence. The bhava. Does not mean becoming. That's a totally different word. It's existence, which creates your new birth. It's wonderful, it's really strange, but just how much you create the world where you think you want to play, where you want to exist. Why were you born in Penang? Because you wanted to? Why you created that world? Because you actually put it into existence. This is especially the case when people are get reborn in heaven realms or hell realms or these other ghost realms. So much of what you perceive in those realms, you created, you wanted. You create your own heaven realms and hell realms. You don't just look at what you read in the books. For example, talking about Penang, when I was there one Christmas time, when we're teaching a retreat in Mahindarama, when they put me in the room, they used the old Pali Sunday school, and I used to stay in the kindergarten room. And I thought, my goodness, when am I ever going to graduate? But in the room opposite, on a Christmas Eve, there was a party. A karaoke party, just on the other side of the street. And so 8, 9, 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock, whenever, when I got back to my room after answering all those questions and teaching retreat, you know, all day, and then got back to my room to have a rest. And the karaoke party was in full swing, just the opposite side of the road. And it's the first time I've ever heard a karaoke party. And the longer it goes, the more drunk they become, and the more out of tune they become. And at that time they really think that they can sing like Lady Gaga, but they sing like a raving crazy banshee, all out of tune, and louder and louder and louder. And for me it was torture. I wanted to go to sleep. And it was this, I wouldn't mind if it was beautiful singing or just nice and sonorous, but that was really hard for me to not allow the noise to disturb me, because that was really disturbing noise. But when it finally finished, I thought, aha, there's another type of hell. And the one I'd be so afraid of, to get reborn in a karaoke hell. Well, I have to listen to that continuously for eons and eons and eons. That is a torture, that is a punishment which really makes me beautiful. And the heaven realms, I saw these heaven realms on the temple drawings. People in little white clothes. I mean, it's really boring. I've worn the same kind of clothes all my life as a monk. Can't we have some like Hawaiian shirts or something? Up in heaven. And playing harp music. I mean, harp might be okay for the first couple of 100 years, but afterwards it would drive you mad and crazy. Not another harp. Oh no! Can't we have some electric guitar or something? And then, the food up in heaven. Ambrosia. It's supposed to be very nice. But ambrosia. Day after day after day, nothing else on the menu. You go to the restaurants up in heaven. What's on the menu today? Ambrosia. Lunch? Ambrosia. Snacks? Ambrosia. Dinner? Ambrosia. I'm not a good. They've got no menu at all up there. Anyway, look, that's the thing, messing around. But you create your worlds. That is really sort of something which is quite fantastic to understand. The world of jhana growth. What is this world here? Is it a peaceful place? Or is it a place you're already finding out all its faults and defects? Are you say, I don't want to be here? Or are you actually creating a sort of a heaven realm? Jhana growth here is pretty good, but you can make a sort of a pain out of this. You think this is like being in a prison. I can't go out. I can't order a pizza. You know, they don't deliver, actually they do deliver, so I better not tell you the numbers. I can't eat in the evening, I can't watch the TV, I can't watch the football, I can't do this, what am I doing this for? You can make a prison out of this place, or you can make a heaven out of it. How much can you make out of this? You have a relationship, you get married. You know, it's really up to you to make that a prison or to make that a beautiful journey together with another person you respect. It's what you make out of these things. Even monastic life. What you make out of it. So this is actually where many of the worlds we live in this life, don't complain, we make it. We make it happen. So, understanding just how much of this world, and some of that is like quantum physics, Schrodinger's equation, you make the world. You're the creator. Anyway, why do you create it this way, not another way? It's partly to do with the craving. This is the first half, or rather the last half of dependent origination. From wanting, craving, wanting creates the fuel which creates existence, which creates rebirth, which creates old age, suffering and death in the next life. But, now is this a person suffering or what is it? So you go to the first half of, you know, when you have sensory experience. You know, we have this thing called Vedana, which is experience, you know, which sometimes can lead to wanting something more. It's very hard not to want something more when you have experience. And the experience is based, on having senses and having the experience of contact and having having the basis of contact. And also they've got this mind and mind objects, the vijnana and nama rupa. Make it simple, just consciousnesses. I made it plural because that is much more accurate to the Buddha's definition. Different consciousnesses, six different types. And when there's something for them to experience, they turn on, they create this contact which creates the what we know as experience, Vedana, stuff of life. But where does that come from? When you have consciousness, your consciousnesses, you'll have the different experiences. And you can't escape from the fact that some experiences will be wonderful and some will really upset you. That is our life. All suffering is just the space between two happy moments. And happiness is a gap between two moments of suffering. You know, I used to notice when I started teaching retreats that they'd sort of compare their experience to people who go on these very strict Vipassana retreats for 9 days, where it's really strict. You have to get up at a certain time. If you don't get up, they come and knock on your door and drag you out. Where you have to meditate for such a time, then you walk, then you have to sit, and there's no shirking. You have to do it. And you're only allowed to go to bed at a certain time. No, like soft Ajahn Brahm, are you feeling tired? Go and take a break. No teddy bears. Really tough. But then they said, well, look at the photographs of those retreats. They look so happy. I said, yes, because the photograph is always taken just at the end of the retreat. Which is why they look so blissful. They're going home. So isn't it the case? I noticed years ago when I did actually go to hospital, I felt so healthy once I got out of hospital. Weird, wasn't it? I always was healthy, but you took it for granted. You didn't notice it anymore. But once you've been sick, when you get better, you feel, oh, really good. It's just the contrast. You need suffering to be able to feel happy. Without happiness, there's suffering. When suffering stops, it's called happiness. Welcome just to the roundabout of life. So anyway, that's how it all works. But where does the consciousness come from? Again, and that is because of the first two factors in dependent origination, which are delusion, avijja, not ignorance. Ignorance is just you can overcome ignorance by study and go to university and become a professor, get a PhD. And what does PhD mean? Her ex told me what it meant, PhD. It is? Permanent head damage. It's not very nice saying things like that. Is there any PhDs here? Don't worry. Don't confess. We'll keep it quiet. Anyway. Ajahn Bhamali, he's got two master's degrees. And I always thought it was two MAs. But apparently one of them is an MSc, which spoils my joke, because I was to call him Mama. M-A-M-A. Mama Brown Marley. That would be very nice. And one's an MSC, so it's MAMS. It doesn't have the same ring to it. Anyway, so going back to Awija means delusion. And I'll give you the example of delusion here. This was from my good old permanently head damaged mate, Professor Dr. Bernard Carr. He's a good mate of Stephen Hawking's. I never realized how close they were, but until I saw Bernard, and he said he was even invited to on the red carpet at the premiere of the biopic of Stephen Hawking's The Theory of Everything, like I think they called it, in Leicester Square. He's only a sort of professor, this Bernard. But anyway, he was featured in the biopic of Stephen Hawking, was a very close friend of his. But the nice thing about Bernard, he was a mate of mine. He's the first Buddhist I ever met at Cambridge. Really cool. And we were lifelong friends. And he was also shared an interest in psychic research. We would literally go hunting ghosts together. And not just ghosts, but other really cool, interesting stuff. Such as just the psychology of perception. So this was a famous flower pot experiment done in, I keep on mentioning this, but it's a great little piece of science. This was done at Imperial College in London, where one of his mates, this well-known scientist, declared that he was going to demonstrate in a laboratory in one of the most prestigious science institutes of London University, Imperial College, levitation. And he managed to get all these great professors and lecturers and experimental physicists and objective scientists to come to witness the demonstration. Levitation in laboratory situation. And so, if ever you remember those old lecture theatres, especially in science colleges, they had a big wooden bench in the front with a blackboard on the back. And they had these tiered seats going up to the windows. I think in the United States they call it the bleachers or something. But anyway, I don't know why they call it bleachers. But anyway, like tiered seats so people in the back could actually see the experiment on this big wooden table. And there was no sort of wires or anything. And so the demonstrator, you know, the person who's going to show levitation, brought a flower pot into the room and put it in the middle of the table. I'm now going to demonstrate levitation. And they had cameras rolling, infrared cameras, ordinary cameras. You can take flashlight cameras if you want. Get out your cell phones and photograph this to see if it works. And then to start the experiment, an important part of it was to create the atmosphere. And he wanted everybody to start chanting, Om, Om, Om. You know, the ancient Indian sort of holy word. And so, I would love to have seen this. All these old professors, you know, English professors, being photographed, going, Om, Om, Om. They did. They cooperated, and they were all going, Om, Om. And that flower pot rose up into the air. It levitated. It worked. It was caught on camera, photographed, infrared everything. And afterwards, now when it went down again, they asked them, what do you make of that? We demonstrated levitation. And a couple of those professors said, what are you talking about? That flower pot stayed on the bench all the time. It's on the photograph, fake. You doctored. So no, it actually rose up in the air. It did rose up in the air. But many of those scientists denied it ever happened. And they were objective scientists. He said, that's what we saw. It just stayed on the table all the time. Now, going back to what was happening, underneath that solid wooden bench was this huge, powerful electromagnet. And as anybody knows who's done any science, when you turn on a machine which draws an extremely large current, you always hear the hum of the current. And the chanting of Om was just to mask and hide the fact that this was a large current going through a very strong electromagnet. So no one would suss out the trick. So it wasn't really levitating, it was just, you know, just magnetic levitation. But that wasn't the point of the experiment. The point of the experiment was it did actually rise above the table by natural means. But because those experimental scientists, trained observers, were of the opinion it cannot happen, it can't happen. So to them it never even registered in their conscious awareness. It was blocked before they ever became cognizant of it. So to them, they were being honest, they never saw it rise above the table. Stayed on the table all the time. That is the power of delusion. And our problem is we never know that we're deluded. I was saying to my last Wednesday night talk over in monastery, there's a really good old friend, dear old friend, his name was Ajahn Ananda. He was an ex-US Marine from Buffalo, New York. He just was in a street gang. He would actually go around with bicycle chains, killing people, basically. He joined the US Marines in the Vietnam War to get tougher. That's the sort of violent guy he was. Just, oof. But you know, he got shot in the back of the head in Vietnam, thought he was going to die, and then surviving, but the doctor in the US Marines said, you know, you're going to be blind. No way you're going to see, because they had to take a lot of his brain out. And anyway, sort of that when they took the bandages off, he could see. He wasn't blind. And he had this natural high, you know, that he thought he said he was going to commit suicide. He would have done that very easily. He's very tough. And he could see, so he had this beautiful high for many years. And then what happened was that he was on a government pension, didn't need to work for the rest of his life. He was playing baseball with his friends. And somebody hit the ball high up into the air. And it's in his direction, an easy catch. And so he followed the ball, and then he said the ball vanished. It just disappeared. And he'd never seen anything like that in his life before. And then, three or four seconds later, it sort of appeared again. He realized he had a blind spot in his vision. Because of his injuries and removing part of the brain, there was a part of his vision which just did not exist, like a hole in the screen. But what happened was the mind filled in what it expected to be there. And so he could never notice his blind spot until he was catching a ball. If he saw the clouds, where the blind spot was, his mind perception would fill in the space where the clouds were. He saw a person and he realized, oh, I know you. And then he'd fill the rest of the face in as he would expect it. And this was his personal experience. Blind spots. The reason we call them blind spots is you don't notice them. You can't see them. And your mind fills in what you expect should be there. And that's also blind spots in our perception. Mind fills in what we expect. Flower pots don't levitate. So it filled it in. It was always on the table. That's one of the reasons why we call it avijja, delusion. We don't realize it's scary sometimes how many blind spots which we have. One of the obvious ones is when you fall in love. She is the most beautiful girl in the world. Oh, I'm so lucky that she loves me too. Oh, I'm the happiest man in the whole universe. 2 years later, what did I marry her for? She said, what did I marry you? Okay, I mean, that's an exaggeration, but don't expect any romance from a monk with a leash around the end. That's why I sometimes say in marriages. Well, I did marriage blessings. I could have bite my lip a few times. But sometimes I say, and I've done this, I've said marriage is like a pack of playing cards. You start off with two hearts, and then you get a diamond, and then you end up with a club and a spade. but that's the delusion of marriage. But if you're wise, then you can make something out of it. A lot of like selflessness. Yeah, you have to let go. So anyway, that's going back to where I was going for Awija. That's delusion. The delusion is, the two main delusions, you think you are, that you are a person, a being, a soul. What do you think you are? What do you take yourself to be? What you take yourself to be, you know, is the agent in control of your life. The will. Your autonomy. It's something which our constitutions try and protect at all costs. Your individual autonomy to be able to choose and do whatever you want. No, within reason, obviously, but at least to have a lot of autonomy. And the other thing which you think you are the person who feels all of this, who hears these talks, who knows the will and the consciousness. That is a big delusion. So what from delusion, from Awija, that creates what we call the karmic formations, volitional tendencies, the will. Sankara number two, independent origination, is the will. Short and sweet, but that's it. People don't like to admit that, but evidence is there. So it's from delusion you create will. You think that by being more willing, stronger, with wisdom as well, that you can find a happy path in this world. Yes, you've fallen over many times, you've stumbled, you've hurt yourself, but that's because you're stupid. You train your will, you go on a retreat, and you enhance your will with wisdom. And that way you'll be able to avoid all the pitfalls of life and live happily ever after. It's not will is the problem. It's just my will is so stupid sometimes. It does all the wrong things. We never actually doubt the will itself. So, because of will, we create consciousness. We know, we explore the world because we want to. Now what happens? Dependent origination also has its dependent cessation. What happens when you do become wise? You wise up to what's really going on. That's tough. It's not what you expect. To see through your blind spots. To realize you see what you want to see and you just suppress what is a bit discomforting. And what happens is that you stop willing. You calm down your will. You let go. You relax. You sit here peacefully, not wanting anything in the whole world except for what you have now. It may not be the best. Jhana Grove may be too hot today, or too cold. Still my good friend, Jhana Sarano. Oh, it's early sleep. I slept really well last night because, you know, there are no blankets on. They're just nice and cool, just my sort of temperature. And poor that Jhana Sarano had to get up in the middle of the night to get another blanket on. So totally opposite. But, so, you know, sometimes, you know, you will, if I do it, think of all these little ways. Okay, Ajahn Brahm, we can have one of these reverse cycle air conditioners. So we can get the heat from your room and transfer it to Ajahn Nisavana's room. Because I've got heat which I don't want, he hasn't got enough. So we have all this thinking and willing. And what I'm saying is just let it go. It's not perfect, but it's good enough. When you start to let go, not encourage your will, you find life gets very peaceful and happy. It's called meditation bliss. And that starts to get you contemplating, exploring. My will promises to get me everything I want. If I just will, strive, struggle! Come on! You can do it. Come on, have a personal coach right behind you. You're nodding. You moved. Don't move, you weren't here in time for the morning meal. Your personal coach. Just to get you. That's terrible, isn't it? But what happens if you really let go and relax, become very peaceful? Sometimes it's amazing. Everything that the will promised you, you receive when the will becomes inactive. Peace. Being in this present moment. It's the will which takes you out. Happiness. Fulfillment. Being here. Relaxation. Rest. And so you get, and it goes much deeper than that. When you're still, when you put down the cup, it gets incredibly still. You didn't do it, you got out of the way. And it happened by itself. Later on you start to see that when you really get into a very still mind, you don't do it. Your will is actually vanishing, being subdued. And you go out afterwards, after a very still meditation, which you never did. You got out of the way and the mind became so calm and peaceful. You go outside and you see everything, the grass, the clouds in the sky, the view of the trees becomes gorgeous. It's enhanced. It's just, you know, the usual thing which people say, it's like someone's been out there polishing the blades of grass. And it's like fluorescent. Everything looks more and more beautiful. That's a sign of strong mindfulness coming because you've subdued the will, the doer, the active part of the mind. So after a while you think, why am I doing so much? Okay, I'll give this stuff a little insight story now. It's really difficult to get up really interesting similes about letting go of the will, what happens. But this is one of the best which I came up with. And this is the donkey and the carrot simile. And I usually change it wherever I go. I think the last time I think I gave this one over in Malaysia. And oh, actually it was here, but it was a group of Indonesians and Singaporeans. So I changed it from the donkey and the carrot to the donkey and the durian. Because Indonesians and Thais as well, they love durians. But let's call it a carrot. Actually, it's probably more... No, let's call it a carrot. So there's a donkey. And the owner has to get the donkey to move, to carry the cart or the people. But donkeys are really stubborn. They just will not move. Even if you get a stick and beat the donkey won't move. But that's not how you use a stick on a donkey. Instead, you tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you tie a carrot. Or a durian. Or what else you like? A mango? Mango? Anyone? Okay, mango. And you put like a mango on the end of the stick. And so donkey sees the mango at the end of the stick. Donkey likes mango. So what does donkey do? Moves towards the mango. But when the donkey moves, so does the stick, so does the string, so does the mango. So the mango is always about a couple of feet in front of the donkey's mouth. No matter how much it strives to catch the mango, no matter how fast it runs, the mango is usually only 2 foot in front. You can see it. You can smell it. You can almost touch it, but you really, it goes away from you. If you ever had that in meditation, you'd almost get the alignment. It's just right in front of you. And you know, all of a sudden it goes away, damn it. So many other things in life, happiness, satisfaction, a beautiful relationship. You see right in front of you and you just go towards it and it all falls apart. So what happens is, you see it, go towards it. So you start running. You really run fast and that mango is still 2 feet in front of you. But then, you remember the Buddha's teachings. Let go. Stop. Relax. So the donkey stops. And then what happens? The mango swings further away. That's why people say, Ajahn Brahm, when are you going to start teaching us meditation? Come on, I'm getting nowhere. I'm just falling asleep. I'm just thinking too much. My mind's really restless. Come on, help me, Ajahn Brahm. It's just like the donkey. The mango starts going further away. Say, ah, it's not working. It's going further away. Patience. This is only the first or second day. Just, you know, hang in there. Have a little bit of confidence and faith. I know what I'm doing. So just relax. So many people, the first couple of days of the retreat, they go, no, more tiredness, more restlessness, eating too much, whatever it is, no, anything else is not working. The carrot's going further. But then, one day, it happens. The carrot's never been further away. You think, this meditation, I did much better when I was meditating with this other mob down the road. You know, with Ajahn Brahm, it's just hopeless. It's just a nice time, enjoying ourselves, no pressure. But my meditation's all over the place. Just hold on there. Don't move. And then you start to notice something. The carrot swung all the way, 4 foot in front of you. And then it starts to move towards you. You get up in the morning and you cross your legs or sit on a chair and it's peaceful. You say, well, where did that come from? I never did that. You start to be aware of something about the breath and it's nice. How did that happen? I never focused on it. I never struggled. I never decided I'm going to watch the breath. It's just there. It just, lights come up in your mind. Wow, this is really good. It just happens. I never did it. The carrot starts swinging towards you, and at one point its usual position, you can recognize it's 2 foot in front of your mouth, but now it's coming towards you full speed. You never had that before. All these things happening really fast and you're not doing anything. So you don't move, you don't get excited, and then the carrot swings, goes right in front of your mouth. But I do my butts as well. You must always remember, it's not just about letting go and mindfulness and meditation. We always talk about kindness, compassion. It's such an important part of Buddhism and meditation, which people often forget. So just when this cow is swinging towards you, about that far away from your mouth, always remember compassion. Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. Come in. Otherwise, you can imagine this carrot comes so close, it bounces off your teeth and back again. Because donkeys have got really big teeth, you never watch a donkey. Huge! Off the teeth and bounces out again. Damn it, I forgot my compassion. That is how donkeys catch carrots. Simple, isn't it? That's how people become enlightened. You've been running after things for such a long time. Doing so much. So you get avijja, is delusion, think you can do this. You are the problem. Your will. Doing stuff. So that is let go of. Stopped. You don't run after things and then carrots come to you. That is how it works. From delusion it makes will. Will makes the consciousnesses, especially in your next life. I could do it next time, and from that will, all the senses and sense bases and experiences. And that creates more wanting. More wanting for more experience. Don't know why people do that. Even every now and again, I get to travel to some really cool places, like Las Vegas. I went to Las Vegas a couple of years ago. Should I tell you what happened in Las Vegas? I can't, because what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. No, they asked me, do you want to go and see the Grand Canyon? It's just, you know, a couple of hours trip away. What do I want to see the Grand Canyon for? Who wants to see that? It's just a hole in the ground. It's erosion, that's all. Just erosion. You wait after a big rain, you can see erosion down the gully over there. What about when I was, last couple of years ago, over in Toronto? Would you like to go and see Niagara Falls? Have you seen Niagara Falls? If you want to see a waterfall, just go in your shower and just turn on the water. Same. Just waterfall. I just can't get it. I just don't understand. Why do people want to go to these places to see mountains? What type of a mountain? This is Mount Everest. You know, you go to Mount Everest, it's a huge amount of effort to get to Mount Everest. And what do you see up there? Just snow, that's all. If you want to see snow, just open up the freezer. I'm sure that Bianca will give you permission to go and have a look inside. Have you got a bucket list? You know what bucket list apparently is? Things to do before you die. But if you want a bucket list, go and see Bianca. She's got lots of buckets to get a list of things to clean. Bucket list. Anyway, just when you learn how to let go, it's amazing how meditation works. So often on this retreat, your best meditations will come totally unexpected. Sometimes we're meditating, and I'm getting nervous. You just go outside and have a cup of tea. Sit, you know, on one of those chairs. Cup of tea or coffee or whatever, and just sit and watch the trees grow. Not doing anything, not contemplating whatever, but just being. And sometimes you have these moments where you don't want anything else in the whole world. Nothing is missing. Just being here, sipping your tea, just watching the birds, you know, fly through the air, feeling the cool wind over your face, or if you're in the sauna, get a blanket before you feel cool. Or whatever. And sometimes, you ever had those moments, you're happy, you're content. You don't want anything in the world. And if you picked up a bottle, you know the old genie thing, you rubbed the bottle and the genie came out and said, I'll give you 3 wishes. I said, no thank you, not today. But I can give you whatever you want. And you win the lottery. Get rid of all your sicknesses and get healthy. Get rid of all your friends' problems. Get rid of Donald Trump. No, I better not go there. The genius of the ball. You can't do things like that. But sometimes if a genie came, you say, no, nothing, thank you. Don't disturb this moment. That's a sign of you're content. And those moments of contentment, each one of us has had from time to time. When you look back upon them, it wasn't perfect in the sense of, you know, great health, you have everything you want, no worries in this world. You put them aside for the moment. And you got like this, almost like this crack in the wall of wanting. You can see through the other side. Just, what do I want? Just nothing. This is good enough. These great moments of peace, what we call taste of freedom. Freedom from wanting. Freedom from trying to change things. Just this moment. Not forever, but just this moment, just being at peace with yourself and the world. No will left. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, no one to be. This moment is good enough. those moments of peace, they tell you more about meditation than all the talks you feel, experience. So you can just close your eyes and just let that feeling of peace, not wanting anything, total contentment, just really grow inside of you. Like a spark starts a fire. Fire of peace and freedom. Don't want anything in the whole world, just being here. Then you find dependent origination just unravels. Becomes dependent cessation. Not wanting anything in the world. No wanting. No trying to build up existences. No fuel. No birth, no death. Peaceful. And you slowly disappear. You vanish. That can be scary for many people, because as your will starts to slow down and stop, so do you. And that can be the scariest thing, disappearing and not being. That's pretty good, because doing and being are intertwined. Which is why I actually saw this with my own eyes in the walls of the philosophy department in Cambridge University. It must have been 1969, 70, 71. Someone had scrawled on there, sometimes I get the authors of the first two lines wrong. The first line, I think, was "to do is to be." Jean-Paul Descartes. Second line, turn it around. It's not Jean-Paul Descartes, René Descartes. René Descartes, the "to do is to be." And underneath that was Jean-Paul Sartre. "No," he said, "to be is to do. Not to do is to be, but to be is to do." The great existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. And underneath that, to sum it all up, was the great American philosopher Doobie Doobie Doo Frank Sinatra. Okay, that's enough for today. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. So anyway, we have the little interviews now. So please, it's a full compliment this morning, full this afternoon. So please come on time. And has to be for 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, what happens after 10 minutes? You get fined. Fined? Deceit. What? Eject deceit. Eject deceit, yes. I press a button, boom, 10 minutes over. What a good idea. Very good, okay.